The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Hello and welcome. We are on Black Talk Radio. It is Friday night, February 12, 2016 at 9 p.m. And I'm filling in, trying to fill in the big shoes of Robin Benton of Race Talk Treaty. And tonight I have myself, Michael Scott, Equity Matters, and my guest is Andre Turner. And we will get to that. I think Onaji Muid may be calling in as well. And we thought we would lift up some of the work that's going on the ground on an ongoing basis that went into sort of the thinking and strategy behind using the UN visit and mission here to both lift that work and to leverage their report. And so before I get into sort of this mission that we did, I was asked to really, you know, talk about our approach to the work and what we did. And I didn't feel good about just talking about myself and my organization, although I would be glad to share the good work that we collectively and collaboratively do. But I also thought I'd lift up Andre, who was pivotal behind the scenes, but actually didn't get a chance to present the day of, but is still presenting. And I wanted to lift up the fact that, this was an initial report of the UN, and we went through a long reading of that report some time ago, and it's important work, and yet it is a first step. And the final report will be in September. The U.S. has a chance to respond as a government, an official State Department visit. And then, but more importantly, you know, it's not about reports, it's about how do we leverage international attention? How do we lift up existing work that's been going on for years and decades and centuries? And how we use this as a moment to think about how we center ourselves in that work and leverage and build community and build relationship to achieve the outcome and the equity that we want to see, but which has always been so elusive in these United States. So, you know, with that, before I get to, you know, reading off sort of how we approached it, Andre, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your, rites of passage program and anything else you want to share about why you think, this opportunity, to present to the UN Working Group of People of African Descent, particularly around human rights issues, was so critical, in Baltimore where you reside. Or in New York, where you're from, and what would you like to share with both the UN and the people listening that might not have a clear understanding about why this historic visit was relevant and what does it mean to their daily lives?
Well, the first thing, Michael, I want to thank you for having me on the call, and I want to acknowledge you for your continued work around social and human justice issues and developing and building equity and centering ourselves in this particular time, because it makes a difference. And you mentioned the term community, and community is actually the central focus in terms of how rites of passage begins to look at how young Black boys of color begin to actually develop a sense of identity and a life plan and begin to increase their lifespan. I'm an Open Society Institute fellow, and I developed a program, Rites of Passage process called Boys Coming of Age. And at the time, it was designed to stabilize African-American boys from ages of 12 to 17 to ensure that they successfully transition into adulthood. How that connects with the year of African descent, when we look at white supremacy and systemic and racial ethnic inequalities and the oppression, that is something that creates immense trauma and promotes harm during the vulnerable age of 12 and 17. And what happens is you get a young child who's been stripped away of his culture, and they have a fractured consciousness and a fractured identity. And what Rites of Passage begins to do is reframe and rewrite a narrative that systemically dehumanizes and devalues our young Black boys. So, Rites of Passage, what were you going to say?
No, I was just affirming. I was giving the I was giving the amen in the corner.
Yeah. You know, so interestingly enough, the World Health Organization talked about the social determinants and low expectancy and how, you know, it correlates with educational attainment, home ownership, you know, rates of poverty, crime, housing, you know, and all of those neighborhood stressors. And John Hopkins has a study out called WAVE, which is the well-being of adolescents in vulnerable environments. So when we're looking at rites of passage and we're talking about stabilizing adolescent so they can successfully transition into adulthood, we have to look at it completely in context as we look at these different structures that they're interfacing with on a daily basis. And the beautiful thing about rites of passage is we create something called themes in Boys Coming of Age, and it's transformational healthy male expression. And what those themes are their didactic conversations that debunk the myths about what it means to be Black, what it means to create a strong Black identity. And they begin re-scripting who they are from a spiritual, emotional, mental, and physical component. And that automatically bumps up against the Eurocentric narrative that breeds internalized racism in a lot of Black boys. And just to give you, you know, a personal example, up to 17, I had a challenge with my youth, and part of it was around my identity. I did not like being dark-skinned. So here I am, a young African-American male who is Black, and I'm looking and developing a self-identity and concept, and I'm literally fighting against myself. And that gets in the way of manhood and masculinity. And then what happens is when we internalize that racism, we start looking at many of the things that we do to compensate, which is get into, you know, premature sex. There's drugs, there's alcoholism, there's all kinds of things to numb the feeling of devaluation. And that's what our boys are dealing with. The blow up that we had and the unrest that just happened in April is a continuum and a cycle. We've seen it many, many times in the 90s. We saw it in the 80s. And it's a continuation. And rites of passage is a public health tool that begins to support young boys. And more importantly, it stabilizes the community. Because once we stabilize the individual, the individual is connected to the family, and the families are a connection of communities that begin to align on values and identities and historical culture. And the biggest component inside a rites of passage is also having healthy, emotional, mature, masculine men. And when we're looking at a conversation around reparations, is looking at what damage and what harm has been done and what continues to happen around deindustrialization and disinvestment communities. I think it's very interesting that, you know, while we're having these debates, we're listening to Bernie Sanders and, you know, Hillary Clinton and some of these folks having these conversations about, you know, what the damage of mass incarceration has done to our families and our communities. You know, it's those kinds of things when we're looking at talking about repairing that makes the difference. And I'm less interested in what they have to say and more interested in what we as a community say we're going to do for our young Black boys to stabilize our families and communities. Because at the end of the day, most people look at rites of passage singularly as what we're going to do for these boys. Rites of passage is about stabilizing families and communities. And, you know, we've taken a hard hit historically as it relates to oppression and systemic racism and racial and ethnic inequalities. And, you know, rites of passage is one of those shields that supports us and gives us a buffer to begin building our future. And, you know, I'm just excited, you know, for what support we're going to get from the international community as we raise the flag of humanity, starting here in the United States and then going abroad, because, you know, our babies and our young boys, cross-culturally and internationally, are having, you know, very much the same challenges. And I believe that rites of passage is that structure that stabilizes and gives young boys an opportunity to redefine and create self-determining practices that are health promoting, and create a strong identity, and it increases their lifespan.
That's right. I mean, you said so much. And first, let me just you know, acknowledge you for putting your, you know, courage out there and leaning into, you know, how you've dealt with and knowledge and wrestle with your own internalized oppression. I say, you know, it's the toxic lake that we all swim in, and how we process that is really critical. But you also listed a number of things, and I don't know if you've ever seen the little baby TED talk, the TEDx talk that I did, but I, in that and also in my submission, you know, started, they wanted to know, you know, who you were or your title or whatever that was, affiliation, but really, for me, it was an opportunity to, as you do, like the past, center ourselves in culture and say who's you were, whose grandson, whose son, and really put the context of my rites of passage as an actionist, which is, you know, not an activist focused on action, and you know, in a familial context, right? And so,
correct.
You know, in that talk, I said, look, you know, I'm part of a centuries old, you know, we're in the center of the Underground Railroad in Maryland. And, you know, I'm just trying to do my part in that chain. You know, my grandfather was born before the Civil War. And so I often think about what, you know, he came along and actually, you know, witnessed the end of the Civil War as a toddler, time he was 5 or 6, and then, you know, grew up during Reconstruction. And I often wonder, you know, what that was like to, as soon as he came into his own as a young man, have to see, you know, the backlash of Jim Crow and what that meant for his development and the lessons and the phrases that I know that come from him that passed down to my father are really interesting to think about. So anyway, I started my piece there talking about that history to kind of give context. I didn't do it in the UN piece, but in my TED talk, I talked about what the lessons learned from those ancestors were, to your point about life expectancy, is that, you know, they found a way to live in abundance, even in the midst of, you know, a demonic period. And it turned out that they were able to have longer life expectancy than most black men of that era. And so I think that's something for me to meditate on. And with my message, is how do we live in abundance? How do we recognize our piece in the chain? And so that we can have, you know, success based on, you know, spiritual, cultural, mental and physical outcomes that allow us to build up our communities. And so I think, you know, the rites of passage and the historical analysis is a really critical part. But the other piece that I think I want to lift up is the health piece. Go ahead. You're going to say something.
Well, no. And you're right on it, because it's looking from a communal and self, as a communal component, around developing a mentality for health and achieving optimal living. One of the things that we have, as a framework and a base is the Nguzu Nani. Most people are familiar with the Nguzu Saba, which is 7 principles of Kwanzaa. We add one more principle, is 8. And Kuji Jakalia, which is self-determination, is really building in at a very early age, how do I affirm and project who I am? Because we say, we teach our young boys to project themselves. And inside of projecting who they are from an optimal perspective, then they perform at an optimal level, and then they produce, you know, they produce results that are commensurate with, you know, optimal projection. So I just want to include that. And our ancestors, with the odds that they faced, specifically your grandparents, you know, it just built a lot of grit in. And that's, you know, just we were faced with some insurmountable odds and hurdled them and really had some grit. So you're absolutely right. And I'm, you know, really proud of the work that they did do, considering the circumstances.
That's right. And, you know, the health piece is really, you know, I like to say that, you know, the measure of any civilization is really how long people live and their quality of life. And so when we look at the life expectancy of white Americans versus black Americans, it's really interesting to think about the three-fifths compromise, right? And so, you know, we were about half the life expectancy of white for, you know, well, and first of all, white folk weren't living, they were only living 40 years old. It took them, you know, almost a century and a half, almost 2 centuries to get that to 45, right, from 40 to 45. And we were half of that for most of that time. And, you know, when we look at in Baltimore and the uprising in Freddie Gray's neighborhood, and we talked a little bit about this the last time I was fortunate and blessed to host the show, is that, you know, there's a 29.6-year life expectancy gap in the neighborhood Freddie Gray lived. And we talked about it in the context of public health because no one has ever contested our numbers, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, if you look up the official number from the health department, it's 20 years. And so you have to ask, you know, what's going on with it? Well, 29.6 years makes Baltimore one of the worst in the nation. I mean, it's probably, I don't know if it's the worst, but you'd be hard pressed to find many more that were higher. 30 years of life, man, that's tremendous. And that's, which is interestingly, you know, almost a third less. So it's almost that three-fifths compromise number. So something really interesting about having built that into the hard wire of the country, and then we're actually living those differentials. And so, you know, I think we have to ask ourselves how our institutions are serving us. And what the UN does is allows us to do some comparisons, as you said, throughout the diaspora and the international community to kind of really reflect on what's going on in our own spaces, in our own neighborhood, and really, you know, begin to have a conversation. I mean, we know these shocking stats about, you know, 12 times difference between white and black wealth, and, you know, you know, just the nature of the many, many disparities. You could be here for a long time talking about that. But the question is what do we do about it? And so for us, when we had the opportunity, you know, we really wanted to lift up, as you talked about, some of the institutional stuff that shows up. And Tamara Jones is a name that folks should know. She's a brilliant woman from, she was originally, she's now at Morehouse School of Medicine, and she's the president of the American Public Health Association. She was formerly at the Centers for Disease Control. And she talks about how racism shows up. And she says, you know, too often institutionalized racism shows up as inaction in the face of need. And see, that's really critical from a public health standpoint because, you know, she talks about the three core functions of public health. So the first one is that it is to assure the assurance of optimal health. Now, we know that's not true given the disparities that we just talked about. The other thing is to be able to measure this thing, right? And so we do have some measurements, but now here we go with, in Baltimore, we have a discrepancy. We have civil society even using the academy and public sector data and coming up with a very different result than the official published version of the health department. Because why? Health is political. So, but the second core function of public health is measurement. You should be able to measure, you know, these things, this thing called avertible death. That's death that should not be. It's statistically aberrant. It does not need to exist. It's inequitable. And so, you know, measuring. But the third piece is policy development. What do we do about it? And so, you know, year after year, we hear these very, medical, we call it the medical model, where we want to blame those that are, on the receiving end of these inequities. Oh, they're just not compliant. Oh, they don't exercise right. Oh, they don't eat right. Not really examining the root causes, right? Not examining the food context, the built environment that they live in, or the choices that they have. And I often say, you know, if you give somebody all bad options, the chances of them making good choices is very low. So if you have all bad options, you're going to make bad choices unless you have, you know, the luck of that one Horatio Alger story, which they love to hold up, don't they? And say, oh, well, he did it or she did it, so why can't y'all? Well, the stats are built against us. So, you know, part of our work is really changing that narrative from we got to, you know, beat the odds to no, man, we got to change the odds. We have to change the house rules. You know, when the house, you bet with the house always wins. So for too long, these public institutions, you know, obviously have not been serving us. And so, you know, using public health to say, look, there are these three core functions and none of them are serving our community. So what are we going to do about that is one of the ways that we began to kind of frame a larger argument, frankly, of genocide. And so the second piece that we did was to say, again, from Chimera and the other working group, part of American Public Health and other institutions, to say, well, what is this thing called, you know, health equity? And what do we need to achieve it? Well, there's three things, according to Chimera. You need to value individuals and populations equally. And we certainly don't do that because if we did, then, you know, we would be taking greater action. And a lot of people don't know this stat, but the amount of preventable, avertable, inequitable death is equivalent to an airplane full of black folks falling out of the sky every day. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, century after century. And yet, we pretty much just shrug, right? Now think about that. In contrast to 9/11, where four airplanes fell and our whole world shifted. So when we talk about the way institutional racism shows up as an inaction in the face of need, we're talking about things like, you know, Nancy Krieger, I think she's at Harvard, public health scholar and a social epidemiologist. She's called for police brutality to be looked at as a public health crisis and to be monitored by health departments so that, A, better data can be collected, but also we can begin to kind of, you know, create collective action from a different angle. This is all about how do you create leverage? How do you create openings? How do you create allies that aren't usually thinking and working together. So, you know, for us, it was like, yeah, well, if these are the functions of public health, and you got to think of the billions of dollars that you're spending here. And then you say, well, so to achieve health equity, we've got to value populations. We clearly don't do that. The second thing she said you have to do, though, is you have to recognize and rectify historical injustices. And so that's where that reparations conversation becomes so critical, and how we recognize harm, and how do we solve for it. Everybody wants to talk about 40 acres and a mule or a dollar, but there are many ways to do curative justice or restorative justice. And I think, you know, the UN calling for a more focused study and way and getting some of the House bills that's been languishing through, I think was an important step and gives us something to stand on, particularly since France is looking at it. But the third thing that's really interesting is hit reparations right on the head. It's, you know, funding according to need. Now, we know that's not happening. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but these arguments, the sum total says that, well, when health equity is achieved, health disparities will shrink. So as long as these health disparities persist, we know that our institutions, even in the most basic form of care, which is our health, are failing us. And so I think thinking about that and thinking about the shift from talking about genocide as being an intentional thing only, because there's certainly some worry about intentional genocide that's floating in the air, given what's going on in the country and in the rhetoric, and given what's leaked out. But also kind of moving that conversation to say, well, now, you know, we also have to think about genocide in the same way we do murder in the courts. So if you can kill somebody with intent, they call that first degree murder. But if we go out and get the beefing, and I wasn't expecting to come out and kill you, but I end up doing, we call that manslaughter. So the intent is slightly different. So we're arguing, well, if we know that since the beginning of this country, for hundreds of years, and in fact, in our original constitution, we're valued at 3/5 of life, and our outcomes are that, right? I mean, that's the really ironic part, is that, well, maybe not ironic at all. But our outcomes are about 3/5. We have 40-50% of life less than our white counterpart. And so if that's the case, going back to the 1700s when folks sued the E.B. Du Bois, you know, if it's consistent, at some point intention is not as important as disparate impact. So that's one of the things that we really lifted up just on the health side. And so, you know, I'll pause to get your comment there, but I think it's consistent with some of the things you lifted up about our history and what we need to talk about as we connect back to it and our ancestors, as well as folks that are faring similarly across the globe. Because if it were a different outcome, but folks are having the same outcomes that are of African descent all across, and this decade gives us an opportunity to examine that.
Mm-hmm. And genocide is definitely the direct definition to identify and to charge forward with, because when we're looking at our young population, that is the future. Like when we're talking about projecting a future now, and we're looking at the young adolescent population, and we're looking at these systems that are devaluing individuals, and we see the history in the continuum, you know, it's, I myself, you know, sometimes wonder, you know, how we made it. And, you know, I'm very clear that we're very resilient. And at the same time, really want to push during this time, you know, this conversation of repair and rectifying historical injustice. And, you know, this is a, you know, an aside, you know, the Panthers lost, the Super Bowl, right? And we're at the 50th anniversary of the Black Panthers. We just, you know, had the 50th celebration, for the March on Selma. And a few years ago, we had, the anniversary for Brown versus, Board of Ed. There is a couple of critical components that are coalescing, for me, that is creating the tipping point. You know, so I'm very excited again about the work that you're spearheading. I'm excited about the people, and the organizations, you know, that are doing, you know, yeoman's work, around pushing that agenda forward. And, you know, I definitely am, aligned with the, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. And when we're talking about, again, adolescent boys transitioning into adulthood, facing these circumstances and odds, it really is also lifespan matters. You know, lifespan really matters because we're talking not, we're not just talking about life, we're talking about lineage and legacy. You know, you talked about, you know, the two generations that your standing here on the shoulders of, and I remember watching that TED talk. You know, you had two generations because your forefathers lived very long lifespans, which is just, you know, amazing in and of itself. Lifespan matters, and it takes mature male adults who've moved through a process and then begin to come back and pull these young males through, you know, and we want to create an equitable playing field, you know, and we want to be responsible for creating that shift. And rites of passage is a very powerful model, again, to stabilize communities. Many people are thinking about the individual boy, but it really is about stabilizing the communities and projecting a future forward. And it's one of those tools to combat against systemic racism, you know, and addressing that framework and giving our boys, our families, and our communities a fighting chance, you know, on both fronts. And being responsible for it as well versus passive. You know, that's the other thing that I appreciate. And you guys are, you know, not only raising your spears and your shields, you know, you're charging forward. And you know, that is very admirable. So I just want to acknowledge that as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, we can talk about, we can pick back up on genocide, but I'd like to also make sure we talk about some of the other strategies and goals that you have related to rights of passage applying to build community. I also want to lift up a part that we didn't really get to talk as much about during this submission. We put a little bit in there, but the wealth piece. Because to us, when we talk about systems and the ideologies that shape systems, which then institutions implement policies all the way down to organizations, we really don't talk about how we think about wealth enough. So I'd like to do that when we come back, and you know, have you talk about some other solutions. We could talk about genocide all night. Maybe we need to lift that up a little bit more to make it clear. But I really want to talk about strategies and goals and some of the solutions that you have as well, and some of the thinking that we have around wealth and how that relates to the same systems that create opportunities for health and wealth as well as inhibit. So why don't we do that in a minute.
Absolutely.
To make some love.
Black Talk Radio, your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Well, welcome back. And, you know, before we get into some of the strategy and goals and some of the talk about wealth, I see Onaji was trying to call in. Hopefully he can get patched in. I wanted to quickly run through this notion of genocide, because for some folks it's obvious and they've been doing this work a long time and we're standing on their shoulders. But I think, too, using, you know, the definition of the UN and asking them to expand it is really interesting given this moment in time we found ourselves in during a Donald Trump campaign. So I'm going to try to speed through this. Are you there?
Yeah, this is Onaji.
Hey, Onaji, how you doing? Welcome.
Yeah, but I would love to join that conversation.
Well, I appreciate you and your leadership, and I will let you get some words in, and you know, we don't have to go through the genocide piece, but I do want to lift up at least a couple of pieces about that, and you can talk to us about some of your thoughts as we talk strategies and goals of the work that we're doing, as well as how we talk about wealth a little differently. How does that sound? Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
So genocide is defined in Article 2 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide back in 1948 as any act of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, as such killing members of the group, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. I think we got some argument on in part at least. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. So, you know, there's also a whole bunch of sub things. And when we talk about intergroup relations, you know, the only other two countries in modern state history that had explicitly social stratification by race by law was South Africa and Nazi Germany. The other piece that we have to consider is just the incredible disparities from health to wealth. And so circumstances that affect the capacity to prevent genocide, I think we have really good standing to talk about. And, you know, there's just a ton of evidence. The presence of illegal arms and armed elements, I mean, it's pretty fairly obvious what that's looking like in the U.S. Motivation of leading actors in the state and region acts which serve to encourage divisions between national, racial, ethnic, and religious groups. The front runner of the Republican Party is the leader of that. I mean, that stuff is parallel to the rise of Hitler in some senses. And so, you know, on each one of these sub-points, there's just a plethora of information. So what we've said is, you know, we really need you to look at how local populations are perpetuating acts, how circumstances that facilitate perpetuation of genocide and dynamic factors. You know, any events which, whether gradual, sudden, or suggest a trajectory toward this is important. And so there's an argument to be made that we're one presidential election away from some really scary stuff. And I think there's some other arguments to be made about some less obvious methods of destruction, such as the deliberate deprivation of resources that we've been talking about. And so talking about that resource piece, and it's the fact that no help is coming, I'd like to at least lay out sort of our thinking, and then we'll hear from both of you. So Equity Matters, you know, we really have three goals in terms of increasing power, voice, and the relevancy of civil society to improve outcomes, improve the right human outcomes that we want to see. One is to create what we've coined and trademarked equity in all policies. It's more widely recognizing the increasing the readiness of systems, institutions, organizations, and individuals to advance the practices of innovation and adaptive change. You know, it's a funny thing when someone puts a word like adaptive change in a journal article and blesses it because it's now coming from Harvard or something. When our ancestors have been literally doing it for hundreds of years and we've had to continually adapt. So that when we're doing that, we're supporting and developing the capacity to change. The other thing we want to do is achieve, you know, field-wide recognition for our unique developmental approaches to that, both in adaptive leadership and organization. And have them recognized as essential disciplines for any organization seeking to do social compact improvement or societal improvement and increasing human rights outcomes in the 21st century. But then most importantly, the third one is moving these practices from the margins to the center, right? So, you know, whether it's multi-multi, which is multi-racial, multi-ethnic, multi-faith coalitions, whether it's you know, humans and civil rights and how they converge and understanding the different approaches. And Najee, maybe you can lift some of that up. You know, how we think about equity, how we think about systems change, you know, community organizing, of course, at the center of all of it. And then cultural organizations and community and economic development. Another way of saying is how do we build beloved communities that heal? And so then we do that through our leadership development line of business, our community development, and our consultancy and advisory and perspective transformation, visioning, and implementation. So that's kind of how we get at it. And what we define simply as equity is, you know, in any decision or anything you see, the simple litmus test is who benefits undeservedly and who burdens unnecessarily. That's a simple test. And if we can get you just to think about, you know, that, and how you use your power, because we all have some power, then we are taking a greater step toward equity. So I want to pause there, Najee, and let you get in there and chat a little bit. You know, we talked about genocide, talked about a little bit about my organization, which you asked me to do. And then, you know, maybe hear some strategies from Brother Andre about what, you know, he wants, you know, to lift up for the work that he's doing about how we, you know, really address some of these systems and health and wealth gaps, and then we can talk a little bit more about wealth to close out the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. You're doing a wonderful job. And Andre, I haven't met you, but have listened to the program. Thoroughly impressed. Just a point of reference, I teach the community consciousness aspect of the Rites of Passage program called Blue Nile, which is affiliated with Abyssinia Baptist Church in New York. And that is a key part of the rehabilitation of our people, because we haven't fully digested the war on social systems. I mean, we know that we've been kidnapped, we know we got terrorized, we know that we were enslaved and went through that whole process. But as a people, we have not fully related to the depth of damage that has happened to us in the destruction of our social system. And that's only one way that you can build a social system, and that is through rites of passage, which was the way, the institution that guaranteed it and maintained it. So for you to be on that, it is certainly a very important and significant, the only way that we want to culture ourselves out of this situation. I want to briefly say that Mari Evans wrote an article, The Nature and Methodology of Colonialism in its Relationship to Creativity, over 20 years ago, maybe 30 years. And she says that if you can make a people mystified, dependent, subordinate, and powerless, you have colonized them. So the liberation process is to create education, self-reliance, self-affirmation, and self-determination. So all these points was mentioned in the exchange that you two brothers had tonight. To move from education to self-reliance, you're talking about wealth, is building those institutions of our businesses. So, you know, how do we move our people away from getting education to get a good job to getting a good education so they can start their business? That is the quintessential aspect of what we do, which means you're building community. So I'm going to stop there because I know we have too much time and let you two take it from that point.
Okay.
Okay, great. I'm very familiar, Brother Najee, with Blue Nile. I'm originally from New York. Had lots of conversation with David Miller. And next time I'm in New York, I definitely have to look you up, brother, and see how we can connect Baltimore and New York. The strategies that we've created, and before I even talk about the strategies, the first thing I want to do is talk about the shoulders that I stand on. Paul Hill is, you know, one of our elders who was very instrumental in repurposing a very old and traditional process. Baba Hannibal Afrik, who is now an ancestor. Daryl Kofi Kennan, who is now an ancestor here in who did a lot of work here in Tubman City. And Adamola Ekwulona, who did a lot of work here with the Harambe Collective, with the African National Rites of Passage United Collective. You know, it is through these men and African Rites of Passage Institute that Paul Hill established some 30 years ago that has me be here today. So I'm an extension in the continuum. And it really is, when we're talking about wealth, health is the wealth. You know, there are definitely, you know, institutional components that we want to build into economics, education, entertainment, and I'm not dismissing those. But when we're talking about developing and stabilizing and creating powerful men, rites of passage sets that table for us to do that work. And again, Boys Coming of Age looks at community stabilization, life cycle development, and mature male perpetuation. So it's the adult males who are continually perpetuating their own development in the older age grades that actually has them go back to do the continual work with the emerging adults and the young adolescent males that are moving forward. And then harmonization of the masculine and feminine poles. And, you know, That sounds kind of vague, but what we do is we begin to demystify a lot of the myths that young boys have about manhood and masculinity. And when we cross-reference the poles of masculine and feminine, young boys emerging and transitioning into adulthood begin to move from self-suppression into self-expression because they're tapping much more of who they are as individuals. And again, it just creates a stronger community because it creates those bridges. And, you know, Michael, I got to share this with you. You introduced me to Peter Block, you know, community and the structure of belonging. You know, now he does some very eloquent writing in terms of what community is. You know, but our ancestors had these things in place, you know, for centuries. And when we're talking about social capital and looking at the symbols and the images and the cultures and the rituals and the customs, we created a discourse from life course, life cycle, and through life planning that had an intergenerational conversation that linked each age grade to the next, and we were able to capitalize on the richness and development and the talent pool that we had. So then we could take advantage of the economics, the education, the entertainment, the labor, the law, the politics, some of those institutions that, you know, our ancestor Francis Cress Wells had talked about, but from a generative perspective versus a passive. You know, and we're literally being intentional and deliberate, you know, from a solution oriented base. And rites of passage is very structured, you know, and it gives young males who start an initiation process an opportunity to look again as they move through the various age grades and revision, repurpose themselves, and then take on a new responsibilities to develop and stabilize their communities. And that's the work that we're doing here at Rites of Passage. And just really quickly, with the conversation around trauma, our boys do drumming, they do martial arts, and they do martial arts, camping. And when you were talking about Cameron Jones and she was talking about measurement, there's a book out called The Body Keeps Score by Bessel van der Kolk. And he talks about those key mindfulness tools that address a lot of that trauma and that stress. So our boys are processing unprocessed emotions, and they're really beginning to rewrite their own passage. So I just wanted to share that. And it's really experiential, and, you know, and they're in their own, in their driver's seat for themselves.
Well, that's rich. And that's, we'll have to do another show where we could bring in some of the science. Dr. Adrian Starks, my sister from Alabama, the NIH cancer researcher, and Dr. Lawrence Brown at Morgan, talks about that, the trauma, and how that's rewriting our DNA and our epigenetics and all of that. But I also wanted to on that notion of rites of passage and what you said, first of all, I want to acknowledge what she said, I like Peter Block, and, adaptive leadership is the same way that, Black Pain makes a great white jobs program. And, for years, we've had brilliance in our community, and other communities have been able to repackage it and resell it. And that's part of what the dominant culture is able to do in ways that we are not always able to execute. But I think that's, begs a different question, is that as you're training these young men, we talk a lot about cooperative economics, but I think we're at a point where, the biggest capitalist nation on earth is under the realization that something about the way it does business is not sustainable. And I think teaching young men not just to be business owners and entrepreneurs, because we run the risk there if we just do that, of having them separate from us, right? And so you often find, I was trained pretty well as a capitalist, and what you find is a natural distancing that occurs. And so people talk about the five C's of credit, and one of them is character. And the problem that I always found with that is the character they're talking about is about, well, will you repay me? They're not really talking about the character related to the larger sense of belonging and structuring belonging of people to community. And so this notion of conscious capital really intrigues me. I think in the same way that rites of passage can kind of rewrite those narratives in a very powerful way. We know that there's a science, there's a lot of neuroscience to that. Even though we know it from ancient technology and not, sort of modern science, but there's some modern science that backs up what we know from the ancient way that our stories and our oral tradition is powerful. And so now we know we have empirical data. But as you're rewriting those stories for boys, it would be interesting to talk about how we integrate a rewritten story of business, right? So if you ask most business people, unfortunately, what was the purpose of business? They're probably going to say something crazy, like making money. Now that may sound heretical to some business people, but I would pose to you what my friend Jeff Cherry says. He says, no, that's really not the purpose of business in a modern context. Maybe in the industrial age, maybe in the information age, but we're moving to a human age. And so one of the main purposes of business is to actually solve problems, right? And that's a shift of thinking. And it turns out that the data suggests that if you run businesses like that, you actually make more money. So here's the turn, right? So it's like saying, is the purpose of your life to make red blood cells? I hope not. But you have to make red blood cells, otherwise you won't have a life. So similarly, if you have a higher purpose for your life, right, and rites of passage, which helps, hopefully our young men find that, but it's not to make red blood cells. Now, making red blood cells is important, just like making profit is important,
but the how you do it matters. And that's the character that we have to rewrite in the DNA, the narrative story that we have to change. And so it turns out that if you move from a very Eurocentric binary, either or, to a very African both and, right, then what happens is you say, well, wait a minute. No, this is not just about shareholders. This is about stakeholders. And instead of thinking about each of the stakeholders only relevant to my shareholders, I want to actually add value to each stakeholder group, starting with my employees who might have significant ownership, moving to my vendors who can serve me equitably and not as servants, right? My suppliers, my community, my environment, and yes, to my shareholders, because I got to give them back their money in return. But if I can add value to each domain, I actually make more money. And people give me the benefit of the doubt. And that's the pivot. And I think we have to really think about our wealth creation a little differently. And I think we have to be, you know, at least in the axiological sense, which Ed Nichols taught me about, you know, really about shifting from, you know, what spins our culture on its axis, what are the values around which we rotate. And I think we can have a healthy approach to business and building wealth. And the brother that just did the venture fund, you know, we need to be doing more cross-border crowdsourcing and thinking differently about, you know, how we teach business and the responsibility and the purpose of business in the same way that we are shifting narrative and DNA in our boards as they're coming to this.
Yes, absolutely. I'd like to say this is International Decade of African People, 2015 to 2024, and the theme is recognition, justice, and development. So the question at this point is, how do we take that which we're already doing, place it in the context of the decade, and begin to create, which I call organizational synergy. We don't necessarily need another organization. We just need the organization that we have to work together in a cooperative fashion.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's right. I think that's the opportunity that this decade presents, and why it's important to go through processes like the UN Working Group of People of African Descent presenting and realizing that no report has ever saved a life or changed a circumstance. But what we're doing is we're building community, right? We're building dialogue. We're checking in with each other on how it's going and what's our experience, what's our data, you know, how are they doing it differently, how can we build differently. And I think, you know, using that to lift up the existing work like we've done tonight with Brother Andre, that's been going, as he said, on shoulders for decades, if not centuries, you know, it's part of it, and then being more intentional even about the work going forward. So with that, I think we're coming pretty much to a close. Gentlemen, do you have any final comments or conversation in the last 2 minutes, minute each perhaps?
For me, you know, it really is, you know, saying lifespan matters. And for young boys, health really is wealth, you know, and rites of passage, you know, creates an opportunity and an atmosphere and an environment for young boys, men, and elders to interact, you know, to recycle a conversation, you know, to move our community forward. And I'm just happy to be a part of it. And I'm happy to be on this call and, you know, just, looking forward to, you know, the difference that's going to be made with the work that's being, and work that's being output.
I would add that, you know, sometime in the future, I'll speak to this listening audience about creating social health circles where we can start to talk about what's happening with our health, help each other, and then turn that into a SUSU where we'll start to create the health and the wealth together. The only way out is through. Through is through us, through our minds, through our acts, through our deeds, through our
our lives. So Susu, that's the answer, you know, creating Susu circles.
Well, I like the way that sounds. And, you know, for us, you know, just to put it in, you know, real basic colloquial terms, what we're trying to do with equity is make it smart, strong, and cool. We want to bring the sexy back in equity. And I think a lot of times, you know, the modern world beats us down and makes us cynical. So I like to say, you know, when you choose hope, when you choose abundance, when you choose equity, you're pushing through. And that's what you get to the other side of cynicism. And if our ancestors can do it, then we certainly can. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you for the time that you've given to us and your brilliance. Robin Benton of Race Talk Treaty, and Black Talk Radio. It's Friday, February 12th, 2016. And we're coming to the close of our hour at 10 o'clock. And we hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have had. And having it with these two brilliant brothers, and we invite you back again to join us and to build greater and beloved community.
Thank you for having me.
Where did all the blue skies go? Boys in this world from the north and south, you see. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No.